Good evening and welcome to Cheater and the Rude. I am Jeff Chrysler, author of Get Rich Cheating, and joining me as never is Lee Papa, author of the Rude Pundit Blogspot. Tonight, we have a very special conversation. Those of you that love politics and love humor and love things that matter are going to enjoy a discussion between two great collaborators and lovers of George Carlin. Joining us first is going to be, of course, Tony Hendra, who you all know from the final edition and previous discussions here. And he is his Carlin credentials include being the co-author of George Carlin's Last Words, as well as being a friend. And I don't know, can we mention the thing that you're...
Yeah, sure.
Okay, and they are currently in pre-production of a Broadway show or a stage show.
It's actually called New York Boy.
It's called New York Boy. It's about... The life of Carlin. We're going to talk about that in a minute, I'm sure. And my other guest tonight is Larry Gettlin, who is a well-known author and scribe about all things comedy and culture, and has recently published a book called Conversations with Carlin, an in-depth discussion with George Carlin about life, sex, death, drugs, comedy, words, and so much more. One of the things that I've learned about comedy is that brevity is a soul of wit, so you should retitle the name of that book.
Well, brevity may be the soul of wit, but it's not the soul of book selling. So subtitles have gotten very long, and so, keep it up with the trend, I guess.
This is very true. So, Larry, I'll start with you. And by the way, for those of you listening, we're just going to talk Carlin. And if you don't know Carlin, it's a shame, but hopefully you'll learn a little bit about him tonight. I'm not an expert by any stretch. He's been one of the few comedy people I look up to, but... Your book is about a conversation that you had with Carlin. Was it one sit down? Was it supposed to be an interview for a particular project?
It was an interview for Esquire magazine in 2001 for their What I've Learned column. And I got to speak to George. It was actually three separate interviews that totaled 5 hours. And what's great about it is that particular column, they give you leeway to talk about everything, like some personal and the big life issues and war and death and really deep level of topics. So George, I came up with like 20 pages of questions about everything I could possibly think of about his life and his attitudes on the world in general. And he answered every single one of them in the most thoughtful way that you can imagine. I mean, I have never, to this day, I have not had an interview like that where no matter what I threw at the person, they were just so thorough and so reasoned and so intelligent and so warm. And it was a phenomenal, phenomenal experience.
How long, with 20 pages of questions, how long was the talk?
Well, it was about 5 hours total.
Oh, okay. I'm sure you get this question all the time by your book. Any answer or some moment that was particularly surprising or really sticks out with you?
You know, at this point, I mean, I've read over it so many times,
right,
I think there was an overall sense that was more surprising to me is that, you know, if you're a fan of George's, you see how funny he is, you can see how intelligent his material is, but you don't really get a glance at how smart he is until you're able to sit with him or until you've seen or read a conversation, because it really goes so far beyond he's not just a rebel. And a lot of times that comes through. This is a man who has really, really thought through everything he's saying in depth, in more depth than you can imagine. And so I think the most exciting part of the whole thing was just no matter what I asked him, there was an answer that had been thought out over the course of what was clearly long and a long life that was thirsty for knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, I think I have to say when I first sort of came back to George, I knew George from the 60s when we were both sort of comedians on the Merv Griffin Show and struggling around Bleecker Street, you know, picking up gigs and stuff, doing all that stuff, the Llewellyn Davis stuff, you know. we hadn't really had much contact for about 20 years, and I was doing this book called Going Too Far, which was basically a history of what my editor made me call boomer humor, but the explosion of satire that took place in the 60s and 70s.
That shows what editors know, but go on.
Exactly. But I hadn't spoken to George, since he was doing The Indian Sergeant. And And most of the people that I interviewed, like Jules Pfeiffer and people like that who were sort of major, or Paul Sills, I mean those kind of people. I did maybe an hour, maybe 2 hours, interview with them, and I started talking to George. And the conversations were just so complex and so, as you say, that it wasn't just that they'd been sort of well thought out, but they were thoughtful. I mean, he didn't struggle with questions, but he certainly answered them at a depth that no one else had. And it was one, there was one, we did one day of conversations. It was like a 4 or 5 hour phone conversation. And we then did another and another and another and another. We did sort of 5 days of enough conversation for a book, actually.
Now, when was this?
This would have been 1984 or, no, 5 or 6.
Really? See, that's fascinating because that is a period where George did not seem to be happy with where he was comedically at that time. Did you get that sense from him then?
Well, no, and I think, I mean, so this is sort of privileged knowledge at this point, but I mean, looking back, I don't think he was particularly unhappy. I think he was exploring a lot of different things, but he was definitely, you know, on the upswing of his final act, if you will, the great, you know, the great sort of legendary George Carlin was yet to emerge, but...
So the germ of that great 90s material was already churning.
Yeah, well, I mean, as he said in Last Words, it was in the 80s, I think, in part because of Reagan's ascent to the emperorship or whatever it was. He decided to start educating himself, and you know, and reading a great deal, and Village Voice cover to cover, and the Coburns and all those kind of people, and so he was sort of in the middle of that process. And I think this was when he really started to answer questions instead of a pat way. He answered them honestly and with the benefit of this sort of new learning that he was picking up. And that, when we actually started doing Last Words about 5 or 6 years after that, it was even more so. I mean, he had definitely sort of expanded his intellectual range, and I mean, I'm no snob, but I mean, it just staggered me that someone who dropped out of ninth grade, would be quoting philosophers and psychiatrists and deconstructionists, thank God, but pretty much, you know, the sort of top of the creme de la creme of intellectual thought, and absorbing it and making it his own.
It's a good example of the difference between natural intelligence and education, which is implanted. George was definitely the type who was he was primed to learn on his own.
Absolutely.
You know, when you hear stories like the one about his grandfather, his grandfather was a policeman and he would write the Shakespeare's plays out in longhand just for fun. And this was the environment he grew up in. So it's fascinating to see how that affected him. And it really set the stage for everything that came after.
Absolutely. I mean, he was an autodidact par excellence. But
just a moment ago you said you weren't a snob, and yet you just said autodidact.
Sorry. Autodidact is someone who learns how to drive a car.
Before, I know you both have tons to say on the subject, but one question that I've sort of had is from a very uninformed perspective, but knowing what I do know, it seems that Carlin went from a great entertainer to someone who wanted to say something. And I think part of that legacy for the rest of the comedians and satirists that have come since is I've looked at his stage of saying something and taken that as the starting point. Like when I came into comedy, I wanted to say something and use comedy as the medium for the message. And I think there are more people that are maybe trying to do that. And Carlin sort of was on the vanguard of comedy just being for entertainment. To say something. Obviously, there were other people. There were the Smothers Brothers. There was Mark Twain and Lenny Bruce. And people did it otherwise. But he was, it seemed to be, the most sort of mainstream, big-name, successful comedian that then also really had a message. Now, I have a question for you guys in different experiences. Is what I saw and its impact on the future of comedy true? And is that sort of a fair assessment of?
I think it is. And, you know, George always talked about Jammin' in New York, the 1992 special. That was the one that is his favorite. That and he heard from a lot of comedians that Jammin' in New York changed everything for comedians. I watched it this weekend again. I went back, and I was astounded by how that special blends everything that George was ever great at into one concise hour. His the political intelligence, the deconstruction of both domestic and domestic politics and international politics, but also the physicality in the lighter sections. He was still making the same kind of faces, doing the same kind of voices. Every single thing George ever did great is in that special. And that's why I asked about the 80s, because it does seem like the 80s was just time to realize it needed to be brought together on some level and then do that. And by the time he hit 92, it was just so powerful. And I think, to your point, Jeff, the first time that I've really seen this blending of strong political statement without ever losing the funny. It was there the whole time, along with the political passion. And that's just incredible.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have rockets and penises in the Gulf. You have golf courses for the homeless. But above all, you have The Planet Is Fine, which is just like one of the most extraordinary pieces he ever did. And as an essay about so many things. It's not just about the environment. I mean, it's about the self-image of the species. I mean, it's such a smart piece.
It's about all of our obsessions and minutia and everything we deal with.
In last words, he explained that he made a huge discovery when he started doing that piece, and especially in Jammin' New York, because there were 6,000 screaming New Yorkers in that theater. And he said it doesn't matter sometimes if they don't laugh, and that's very true. They're not laughing; they're just listening. But when the laughs come, boy, they're so satisfying. You know, you think a little bit of plastic is going to make a difference. I mean, it's just such a great line.
Well, it's always been. I think it's one of the fine arts that a lot of younger comedians and even more established comedians. You have to sort of let them know that you're funny, so that they trust that at the end of what you have to say is going to be a payoff for that sort of visceral animal need they have to laugh. And then if they trust you, they will listen to what you're saying, and then they will put aside. Like, it's always Will Durst, who is sort of a contemporary great political comic. He told me once at the start, get funny and then try to get political. I, of course, ignored that. That's why we're doing this show right now on PRN. But there's a truth in that. Like, an audience will trust you if you've proven that you're funny. And I think that Carlin sort of hit the double sweet spot of, A, having proven his bona fides, and then in that special, in those moments, forget what he'd done before, just on that stage, he was proving that he was funny, and they would go for it. They'd go, whatever.
Well, you know, there's another counter to that, which is that being a comedian of George's level doesn't get you off the hook if you're not funny. And Seinfeld said a thing about this in the movie Comedian, I don't know if you've seen that, but that was the documentary he did. It was after the show. He was already a half billionaire or whatever, and he went back out on the road to do stand-up. And we see him bomb in the film, and he's already Jerry Seinfeld, megastar. And he said at one point, he said, I don't care who you are, how famous you are, even if you're at my level buys me five minutes. If I'm not funny by minute six, my name is irrelevant. Right. And I think that's true. And George realized that. George would always come on strong. You know, he was very good at grabbing that audience first and then launching it. And, you know, at a certain point, we expected the political from him, so the political and the funny came together very naturally.
Right. But I remember, what special was it where he opened up with something like, all these anti-abortion women, let's...
That was fairly close. It was one either right before or right after Jammin'. Because it was weird. I watched a few of those specials.
The line about why is it that people who are against abortion are people you wouldn't want to fuck in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah. That was his opening.
He actually did that line first of all in Carlin at Carnegie in 1982. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I discovered this weekend watching a few of the specials. I didn't quite realize how often he repeated material in his specials and revamped. Well, not an exact repeat, but did there was one joke he did in the 1990 special and then in the 1992 special. But you saw the evolution of where it fit into the bit and how the whole was a different thing and the whole had evolved.
Well, I think that's actually a wonderful point because the fact that he came out and he actually started the show with that line. And it was like his comeback show, right? I mean, because he had been, you know, Rick Moranis was doing doing George Carlin impressions.
That was devastating.
So this was his comeback, and that's how he came on. That's how he came out and did that. But in that one line is the seed of what I think is one of his greatest routines, which is the sanctity of life, the abortion sanctity of life piece, which is just a staggeringly funny, but staggeringly damaging piece of work. I mean, it's as an essay about pro-life and how little they care about life. It's just devastating. But from that one seed, that was 95. So 13 years later, an entire routine grew from that seed.
Yeah, and also in that routine, the jokes never stop.
No,
he can be ridiculously silly talking about abortion and the whole thing with the chicken, with the omelet, and who says chicken? Chickens are better people, or whatever the line was. Brilliant,
brilliant,
and gets the point across. And yet you have us laughing at chickens.
Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah,
tell us a little.
Not for us, it's an abortion, but for a chicken, it's an omelet.
Yes.
Yeah. If you guys keep referencing bits, we're just going to do nothing but play his bits.
Let's do our own bits.
Tony, tell Larry about this show project, because I got to see a table reading. And are you a New York guy? Did you grow up in New York? I forget.
Yeah, Brooklyn.
Okay, so you might particularly enjoy it if you want to.
Well, so this is a show which actually I've been working on for 3 years, which is it springs from the last chapter of Last Words, which is about George had this abiding dream. He lived for most of his life, certainly his career, in Los Angeles, and when he wasn't in Los Angeles, he was in Vegas. So, but he grew up in New York, and he was a New York boy, and I don't think he ever lost that. I mean, that was part of his grating, wonderful grating.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't an earthy tone; it was a gritty tone, and his dream was to come back and do a one-man show on Broadway, and it was going to be called New York Boy. And actually, one of the reasons we never put out the memoir when he was the sort of biography when he was alive was that the plan had become by the time he died that we would put it out concurrent with him actually doing New York Boy.
Okay.
So about 3 years ago, I went to his executor, who was also his manager, Jerry Hamza, and suggested that we do, a show, a Broadway show, which was a tribute to basically to his life and work, called New York Boy, and make it as much like George would have done if we could see into his mind about what he would have done. And I recruited an old friend of mine from the Lampoon to do this with, a wonderful writer called John Weidman, who's a Broadway veteran and frequent collaborator and book writer with Sondheim, and president of the Dramatists Guild and all kind of stuff. But he did the revival of Anything Goes too. He wrote that. So I mean, he's got a string of sort of very, very strong Broadway hits, and so we've been working on it, and we're still developing it. I mean,
And so this is the story of George's youth.
Well, no, it's actually the entire story of his life. I mean, what we conceived very early on was that we would do it as a musical, and except instead of musical numbers, there would be George Carlin numbers. So
comedy routines.
His great routines, from the Indian Sergeant through to There Is No God, but between that, it's the story of his life. I mean, the story of growing up in Harlem and going to the Air Force and marrying Brenda and all
which
that.
Which is very close to what he mentioned this in our interview too, the one in Conversations with Carlin.
Right.
He talked about he had two possible Broadway desires. One, to do a one-man show about his life, and the other... Oh, sorry, am I close enough to the mic?
Yeah,
And the other to do a show about language.
Right.
And he was hoping to get one of those done, and obviously he did not. But now you've picked it up. That's fantastic.
Yeah, sure. So at the moment, it's kind of deal-making doldrums. But we have high hopes for it.
When do you hope to have this on stage?
It would be good if we could do it by this time next year.
Oh, I mean, I think you're that far along.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, wow.
I just went to a reading. Was last month?
Yeah. We actually did a table read of it in December, which was actually quite quite amazing. I mean, apart from anything else, I think you'd agree, it did prove that that the right person can. There was one particular actor in this read called Patrick Michael Kelly, who's a Broadway veteran again of many plays, and he did a pretty good Carlin. And I must say, when he got into the big pieces, the, like Abortion and you know those pieces, There Is No God, he did a great job. And that's very interesting, because they are so beautifully constructed that they're sort of like, you know, a great jazz solo that actually, after that, the person who did that solo passes on, somebody else can reinterpret it. And I think that's going to be the most exciting part of the show.
And I'm psyched hearing about this, and a little apprehensive. The notion, and I know this, obviously there's no choice now, but the notion of another person standing up there doing George's material as George. I mean, for you, you knew him so long. That's got to be a little bizarre.
Well, we thought right from the beginning, I must say, that, or I thought right from the beginning, and I think I convinced John, that actually these pieces are so beautifully written. I mean, and that's what everyone forgets, because he always did them as if he just thought them up on the spot.
That's the magic of a great stand-up, as
you
were talking.
But in fact, as you and I know, and perhaps not everybody knows, he was incredibly anal about rehearsing things. He did every gesture, every breath. He rehearsed and redid over and over again, and that shows in the structure of these things. They are beautifully put together. So, I think that actually that's the greatest tribute that you could pay to George, is if his material can live again in other people's mouths. I think that's actually a great tribute to the quality of his work.
I'm very intrigued. You know, it's interesting the difference
between.
You
wouldn't do it unless it's hilarious.
Oh, I'm sure. But it's an interesting difference between comedy and music, because when you're doing a story of a musician, you know, we hear cover songs all the time. Cover songs are part of our pop culture. It's not a big deal. But covering comedy, it's an interesting thing. I mean, there's a few, you know, Jim Carrey is Andy Kaufman and Dustin Hoffman is Lenny. We've had a few experiences with that. But in general, I think it's still a little jarring when people see someone portraying a famous comedian. I mean, now there's the Sam Kinison movie in the works. Like, we're probably going to be seeing more of this.
I think there's a few things at play. One is, and maybe this is I'm blinded by being in comedy, is you don't perform other people's material.
Well,
like
exactly.
There's a taboo.
Exactly.
About, whereas you can do other people's songs. That's just in general.
Well, some people do.
Well, some people, not real humans do not perform other people's material.
Not with permission. Yeah.
Exactly. So there's that element of it that it just seems weird. And I think that there are not many comedians that have the style that Carlin did, which is very conversational, but that actually are, as Tony was saying, very treated like a very staged production, that are very, like, to the moment. There are comedians that you can tell are very theatrical, like, you know, they... Pablo Francisco is a guy like he does voices and impersonate, like you can tell. But Carlin is a very conversational, and yet it is so. Like, I think the fact that he does it like in that style makes it easier for an actor to sort of try to fit into those shoes.
And yet, I think it may make George the hardest comedian for an actor to portray, because every element, the voice, the physicality, it was so precise and specific and recognizable. When I did my little George marathon this weekend, there's one bit, and I'm forgetting which it is, but he did it in both the 92 special and the first one, the 77 special. But he works in a joke to a point where he is hunched over completely, just physically, like shoulders forward and whatnot, and then he picks himself up as if by invisible strings to where he's standing perfectly straight. And he did this in both 77 and 92, and you could almost see little differences in how he, you know, found better ways to do it. But it's such a bizarre physical move. It's so specific. It's like something that a mime would do.
Right.
And you're looking at it like that is not going to be easy to replicate.
Well, Tony Show, it's all with the fog machine and auto-tune, so it's going to be fun. Listen,
lights.
But there is one point I want to make before we leave the subject, which is that we told the actors we do not. We told that there are actually two actors play George Carlin, not just one.
Well, he's got to have a long life.
So, but we told both of them, we don't want you to do impressions of George Carlin. We want you to do that. We want you to speak with the spirit of this piece and make it work. But we don't. Obviously, we don't want you to do it in a Park Avenue accent. But you know.
No, it didn't sound like he was doing an impersonation.
Act it. Don't do an impression. And that's why it worked, I think.
Yeah. Listen, we only have a couple minutes left, and there's so much ground to cover. I will put to each of you a last question, which is: anything in particular you think people that are new to George Carlin should know or should listen to, a favorite bit, or just anything that you really think it could sort of sum up a legacy? I'll start with you, Larry. Anything that really...
Well, I think, you know, based on the discussion we've had, my obvious suggestion is going to be 1992's Jammin' in New York to get a real look at the political George, but also for a good look at the sillier George and the transitional George, the album FMAM, which was his first album in what I guess we can call the hippie phase, and yet still had some remnants of his straight-laced days. And there's just brilliant, funny stuff, news parody that he was doing a few years before Weekend Update, which will sound familiar to fans of SNL. A lot of fun stuff. So I'd say those two things. And then, of course, go on to Amazon, and for only $2.99, buy the Conversations with Carlin ebook. That's right, only $2.99. And, you know, you'll get a lot of background on the man and what an incredible thinker he was and what an amazing life he led. He has had a very interesting life.
Cool. Larry, you can also read Larry's writing all the time in The Post, Esquire sometimes, yes, still?
No. But The Post and...
Screw Esquire.
The Post and you know, promoting a book, it takes up the time.
It is a great read. And Tony, any final brief thoughts to sum up a lifetime?
I would say, if you are a believing Christian, I wouldn't bother.
Sure. Unless you're a wavering believing Christian.
Yeah, that's fine. Or gay.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly, same thing. Well, excellent. Well, Tony, I know we can find you at thefinaledition.com. This has been Jeff Kreisler for Cheater in the Root, a conversation with Larry Gettlin, the author of Conversations with Carlin. Find that on Amazon, and Tony Hendra, who you all know. Stick around for the final edition, or stick around for more of What You Live.